Nomoto presents American Presidents. President Calvin Coolidge. Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Ava voice. Running time, approximately 24 minutes. If you enjoy this program, explore the rest of our library. Every show is designed to stand alone, but together they form a larger project, a guided tour of the forces, intellectual, emotional, political, technological, that built the world we live in and the world we're about to enter. In the summer of 1923, a small, spare bedroom in a Vermont farmhouse filled with the soft, uneven glow of lamplight. Outside, the village of Plymouth Notch slept under a sky pricked with stars. Inside, a middle-aged man in a simple nightshirt stood at attention beside the bed where his father, John Coolidge, a notary public and storekeeper, held an open Bible. A telegram lay nearby on a small table, its message as stark as ink on paper can be. The President of the United States, Warren G. Harding, was dead. The Vice President, Calvin Coolidge, who had come home to visit his father and escape the Washington heat, was now, by law and by fate, the new president. There was no grand ceremony, no band, no cheering crowds. At 2:47 a.m. on August 3, 1923, in that quiet, lamplit bedroom, John Coolidge administered the oath of office to his son. Calvin placed his hand on the Bible, repeated the words of the presidential oath, and then, as later accounts have it, went back to bed. The image is so stark that it feels almost mythical, the country pivoting from one presidency to another not in a marble hall, but in a farmhouse above a village store. It captures something essential about Calvin Coolidge. In an era of roaring markets, jazz clubs, and exuberant consumerism, he remained spare, restrained, almost austere. The nation would come to know him as Silent Cal, the man of few words whose very brevity seemed like a political philosophy. Yet behind that stillness lay a complicated story, a childhood shaped by frugality and loss, a careful climb through Massachusetts politics, a crisis in Boston that made him a national figure, and a presidency that both embodied the optimism of the 1920s and helped set the conditions for the crash that followed. Calvin Coolidge was born on July 4, 1872, in Plymouth Notch, Vermont, a coincidence of date that would later adorn campaign posters and biographies. His birthday seemed to tie him symbolically to the nation itself, but his early life could not have been more modest. The Coolidge home was a white, wood-frame building attached to his father's general store. The family raised crops, tended animals, and learned early that money was scarce and nothing should be wasted. His mother, Victoria, was gentle and often ill. She died when Calvin was 12. His younger sister also died young. These losses carved a quiet grief into him that never really left. His father, John, was a figure straight out of New England republicanism, a farmer, storekeeper, justice of the peace, and sort of unofficial mayor of everything within walking distance. He believed in duty, thrift, and honesty, and he expected his son to carry those values. As a boy, Calvin was serious, reserved, and observant. He absorbed the rhythms of town meetings and local disputes. He learned that words, once spoken in a small community, could not be easily taken back. Better to speak sparingly and with purpose. Education offered him a path beyond the rocky Vermont hills. He attended the Black River Academy and later St. Johnsbury Academy before enrolling at Amherst College in Massachusetts. At Amherst, his classmates discovered a young man who was not flashy but persistent. He joined the debating society, edited the student newspaper, and cultivated a dry, understated wit. A professor, Charles Garman, influenced him deeply, teaching a blend of moral philosophy and practical ethics that reinforced Coolidge's belief in personal responsibility and limited but principled government. After graduating in 1895, Coolidge moved to Northampton, Massachusetts, read law in a local firm, and set up his own practice. Northampton was a small but bustling industrial town with textile mills and a diverse population. Coolidge lived simply in a rented room over a store, saved money, worked long hours, and gradually built a reputation as a reliable, unpretentious lawyer. It was in Northampton that he met Grace Goodhue, a vivacious teacher at a school for the deaf. She was outgoing where he was reserved, playful where he was solemn. They married in 1905, forming a partnership that would both soften and stabilize him. Grace's warmth would later humanize the quiet man in the White House. She laughed easily, charmed guests, and brought a certain light into rooms he tended to fill with silence. Coolidge's entry into politics was natural, almost inevitable, in a town where the same men who argued cases in court also argued budgets at City Hall. He started at the bottom, city council, then city solicitor, then clerk of courts. He was not a spellbinding speaker, but he was precise, honest, and stubborn. In an age when many saw politics as a ladder to fortune, Coolidge presented himself as a custodian of public money and public trust. Voters noticed. He became mayor of Northampton in 1910, then moved up to the Massachusetts State Senate in 1911. At each rung on the ladder, Coolidge displayed the same pattern. He spoke little, listened much, and chose his moments. His colleagues sometimes underestimated him, mistaking quiet for lack of ambition. In fact, his ambition was real, but it was channeled through steady accumulation of respect and careful alignment with the dominant Republican organization in Massachusetts. By 1914, he was president of the state Senate. By 1915, he was lieutenant governor. And in 1918, he was elected governor of Massachusetts. The moment that propelled him onto the national stage came in 1919, when Boston was gripped by a crisis that shook the country, the Boston police strike. Police officers, frustrated by low wages, long hours, and dismal working conditions, sought to unionize. When the city's police commissioner refused to recognize their union and suspended union leaders, many officers walked off the job. The result was chaos. With large parts of the police force off duty, looting and violence broke out in some neighborhoods. Newspapers printed images of broken windows, ransacked shops, and nervous citizens. The question facing Governor Coolidge was not just how to restore order, but how to frame the conflict. In a nation already anxious about Bolshevism after the Russian Revolution, labor unrest was often coded as a potential assault on the very idea of social order. Coolidge responded with a statement that would define him in the public imagination. There is no right to strike against the public safety by anybody, anywhere, anytime. With those words, he declared that public employees, especially police, could not claim the same strike rights as private workers. He called out the state militia to restore order, backed the police commissioner, and effectively crushed the strike. Many of the striking officers were barred from returning to their jobs. The decision was controversial among labor advocates, but it electrified conservatives and moderates across the country who feared social disorder. Newspapers praised Coolidge as a defender of law and order. Telegrams poured into his office. The Republican Party, looking ahead to national contests, took note of this quiet New England governor who had stood firm when the streets of a major city seemed to wobble. 2 years later, when Warren G. Harding needed a running mate to balance the Republican ticket in 1920, party leaders saw advantages in picking Coolidge. Harding was a genial Ohio senator with a talent for broad reassurance. Coolidge was a man whose record suggested firmness and restraint. Together, they represented stability. The Harding-Coolidge ticket won in a landslide. Coolidge assumed the vice presidency in March 1921, a role that, at the time, carried little formal power and even less prestige. He presided over the Senate, sat in on meetings, and mostly stayed out of the spotlight. Then, in August 1923, his life turned on that telegram in Vermont. Once sworn in, Coolidge traveled back to Washington and addressed the nation. He made clear that he intended to continue Harding's general policies, but he also moved quietly to distance himself from some of Harding's more problematic associates. As investigations into the Teapot Dome scandal and other abuses in the Harding administration gained momentum, Coolidge adopted a strategy that combined cooperation with carefully controlled outrage. He allowed the legal process to unfold. Cabinet members implicated in wrongdoing were pushed out or prosecuted. He did not defend the indefensible, but neither did he turn his presidency into a crusade against the past. Instead, he projected calm confidence, signaling that the government would function, budgets would be balanced, and the economy would be encouraged to grow. Coolidge's economic philosophy crystallized in a phrase that would be quoted and misquoted for decades: "The chief business of the American people is business." He believed that prosperity came from private enterprise, not government schemes, and that the federal government's primary economic responsibilities were to keep taxes low, budgets balanced, and interference minimal. He embraced Treasury Secretary Andrew Mellon's program of tax cuts, especially for higher incomes and corporations, arguing that lower rates would unleash investment and ultimately benefit the whole country. During his presidency, Congress enacted significant reductions in income tax rates. At the same time, the federal government ran budget surpluses and paid down portions of the World War I debt. These policies, along with global conditions and technological developments, helped fuel the booming economy of the mid-1920s. Automobiles rolled off assembly lines in ever greater numbers. Radios flowed into living rooms. Electric appliances, department stores, and installment credit transformed everyday life. The stock market climbed steadily. In the eyes of many contemporaries, Coolidge presided over a golden age of business. His minimalist approach fit the mood, a government that stayed out of the way while the country got rich. Yet the prosperity of the 1920s was uneven. Farmers, in particular, suffered. During World War I, European demand for American grain and livestock had soared, leading to expanded acreage and heavy borrowing for new equipment. After the war, European agriculture revived and global prices fell. American farmers found themselves trapped between debt and declining incomes. Farm foreclosures rose. Rural discontent simmered. Congress responded with proposals like the McNary-Haugen Bill, which aimed to have the federal government buy surplus farm products and sell them abroad, effectively stabilizing prices. Coolidge vetoed these measures. He believed they violated the principle of limited government and would entangle the state in complex market manipulations. "Farmers never have made much money," he once said with characteristic bluntness, a statement that sounded to many like indifference. In truth, he saw the farm crisis through a lens of individual adjustment rather than structural intervention. The result was that while urban Americans reveled in new wealth, rural America felt increasingly left behind, a tension that would echo long after his presidency ended. On social issues, Coolidge's record was mixed. He supported the rights of African Americans more than many of his contemporaries did rhetorically. He condemned lynching and endorsed federal anti-lynching legislation, though Southern opposition in the Senate prevented such bills from becoming law. He appointed some Black Americans to federal posts and spoke of them as citizens deserving of equal protection under the law. But he did not invest substantial political capital in forcing through civil rights reforms. His preference for restraint and limited federal power curved around into inaction in the face of deep injustice. In immigration, however, he backed restrictions that reflected the nativist mood of the 1920s. The Immigration Act of 1924 established tight quotas that sharply limited arrivals from Southern and Eastern Europe and effectively excluded Asian immigrants. The law rested on pseudoscientific ideas about racial hierarchies and fears that undesirable foreigners would dilute American stock. Coolidge signed the act, expressing the view that America had the right to decide whom to admit and how many. In so doing, he lent presidential weight to a regime of exclusion that would shape immigration patterns for decades. Here again, The cool restraint that appealed to many voters also masked a willingness to enshrine popular prejudices into law. One area where his administration took a more generous turn was in relations with Native Americans. In 1924, the Indian Citizenship Act granted U.S. citizenship to all Native Americans born within the territorial United States. The move did not undo the deep harms of land seizures, boarding schools, and broken treaties, and many Native communities remained under the heavy hand of the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Still, the act symbolically recognized Native peoples as full citizens, a shift from the older view that they were external nations to be controlled or assimilated. Coolidge posed for photographs with Native delegations, sometimes dressed in traditional regalia, signaling at least a symbolic embrace of their inclusion in the American polity. In foreign policy, Coolidge's instincts were cautious and multilateral in limited ways. He continued Harding's support for arms limitation and backed the Kellogg-Briand Pact of 1928, an agreement among many nations renouncing war as an instrument of national policy. The pact had no enforcement mechanism and would later be mocked as naive, but at the time it reflected a genuine desire to find legal and moral frameworks to prevent another world war. Coolidge, ever wary of grand crusades, preferred such legalistic, incremental steps to sweeping international commitments like the League of Nations, which the Senate had rejected before he took office. Coolidge's personal style in the White House was unlike that of almost any other modern president. He kept a strict schedule, went to bed early, and took long naps. He was frugal with words. At state dinners and social events, he often sat silently while others filled the air with chatter. This reticence gave rise to an entire folklore of jokes and stories. The most famous came from a dinner party where a guest allegedly told him, "I made a bet I could get you to say more than two words." Coolidge replied, "You lose." Whether the story happened exactly that way or not, it captured how the public saw him, as the paragon of Yankee taciturnity. Satirists had fun with it, but many ordinary Americans found it oddly reassuring. After decades of fiery rhetoric from progressive reformers and wartime presidents, there was something comforting about a leader who did not constantly insert himself into every controversy. His very quietness seemed like an anchor. Yet the silence also hid an internal sorrow. In 1924, shortly after Coolidge secured the Republican nomination in his own right, tragedy struck the family. His younger son, Calvin Jr., developed a blister on his toe while playing tennis on the White House courts without socks. The blister became infected. In an age before antibiotics, the infection spread. Within days, the boy was gravely ill. Within weeks, he was dead. The loss devastated the president. Coolidge later wrote that when his son died, the power and glory of the presidency went with him. The man who had always been reserved became, by many accounts, even more withdrawn. The country saw the same thin smile and formal photographs, but those close to him sensed a deeper detachment. Still, during the 1924 campaign, the economy's strength and Coolidge's image as a steady steward carried him to an easy victory. He defeated Democrat John W. Davis and Progressive Party candidate Robert La Follette, winning a broad mandate to continue his policies. The phrase "keep cool with Coolidge" adorned buttons and banners. It promised precisely what the electorate wanted: no drama, no upheaval, just more of the same steady prosperity. By the late 1920s, however, signs of imbalance lurked beneath the boom. Stock speculation soared. Brokers allowed customers to buy shares on margin with minimal down payments, magnifying risk. Industrial productivity grew faster than wages in some sectors, raising questions about who would buy the ever-increasing stream of goods. Internationally, reparations and war debts tangled Europe's finances. These issues were not unique to Coolidge. They were features of the larger economic order. But his philosophy of minimal intervention meant that he did little to counter them. The stock market soared. His administration saw it as evidence of health, not as a potential warning. In August 1927, during a stay at his beloved Black Hills retreat in South Dakota, Coolidge summoned reporters. They expected a routine briefing. Instead, the president handed them a simple typewritten statement. I do not choose to run for president in 1928. The sentence, like the man, was concise, unadorned, and final. He offered little elaboration. Some speculated that he was tired, others that he feared a third term would strain the office or his health. Whatever the mix of motives, the decision surprised political insiders, but fit his pattern. Coolidge had never sought to cling to power for its own sake. Having served a partial term, and then a full one, he stepped aside. He returned to Northampton in 1929, just as the economic forces he had presided over reached their breaking point. In October of that year, the stock market crashed. Banks failed. Unemployment soared. The Great Depression began. Coolidge, now a private citizen, watched as his successor, Herbert Hoover, struggled to contain the disaster. Some critics later blamed Coolidge's policies, especially his light regulatory touch and enthusiasm for tax cuts, for exaggerating the bubble that burst. Others argued that no one at the time, of any party, fully understood the systemic vulnerabilities of the new industrial capitalism. Coolidge himself remained mostly silent in public, writing occasional newspaper pieces and his autobiography, but refusing to join the chorus of Monday morning quarterbacks. He died on January 5, 1933, at the age of 60, in his Northampton home, just weeks before Franklin Delano Roosevelt would take office and embark on the New Deal, a project that represented in many ways a repudiation of Coolidge's philosophy of government. The contrast between the two men, Coolidge the minimalist and Roosevelt the activist, became a touchstone in debates about the proper role of the federal state. For decades, Coolidge's reputation dipped. Many historians treated him as a symbol of complacency, an avatar of the heedless 20s, and a prelude to disaster. He was caricatured as a small man in a big office who did nothing while speculative excess and structural inequality accumulated. More recent scholarship has softened that view somewhat, noting his real achievements in balancing budgets, reforming federal finances, supporting some international peace efforts, and maintaining a degree of racial fairness in his rhetoric unusual for his party and time. Yet the broader judgment remains. He was a president whose virtues, restraint, frugality, skepticism of government ambition, became vices when the moment demanded a different kind of leadership. For a podcast listener, Coolidge's story offers a counterpoint to more dramatic presidencies. There are no fireside chats, no New Deals, no wars won or lost. Instead, there is the steady hum of an administration that mainly tried to stay out of the way. His life invites questions about what citizens want from their leaders. After Wilson's crusading idealism and Harding's scandal-touched goodwill, Americans in the 1920s craved calm. Coolidge gave them that. But calm can conceal risk. The very quiet that soothed the public also allowed fragile structures to stand uninspected until they fell. And yet the figure of Calvin Coolidge endures, not only as a cautionary tale, but as a reminder that austerity has its own appeal. In a time when presidents are expected to fill every space with words, his silence is striking. The farm boy from Plymouth Notch, who grew up counting pennies and words alike, carried his small-town virtues into the grandest of offices. He believed, with unwavering conviction, that the less government did, the better. For a while, it seemed to work. It is the task of history, and of listeners, to decide whether that quiet was wisdom, blindness, or some uneasy blend of both.